This is Ken Lubin, the host and founder of the Executive Athletes Podcast, and welcome to this week's episode. I want to thank everyone that has been listening and thank you for the comments and feedback. They're awesome and are an incredible help in this journey to making this podcast better and better each episode. Once again, this is unscripted and unedited, as I believe it is the best way to get to really know the guest. This week's guest is Doug McConnell, and Doug is a unique athlete because he does something I know nothing about. He's a marathon swimmer, which is pretty cool. So I'll jump into the intro. Doug, with the help of his team, a long swim, became only the 48th person over the age of 50 to swim the English Channel in 14 hours that were divided between heavy waves and pitch black darkness. The success of the English Channel swim has inspired a long swim team to continue with marathon swims, including the 24-mile length of Tampa Bay, the 21-mile distance of the Catalina Channel in California, and the 29-mile circumnavigation of Manhattan Island in New York City. The swims of the English Channel, the Catalina Channel, and Manhattan Island make up the triple crown of open water swimming, of which Doug was the 89th person to complete and only the 15th person to complete all over the age of 50. In Doug's day job, Doug has been an investment banker for over 25 years and has deep experience in all types of corporate and financial transactions, including M&A, private placements of debt and equity, public new issues of debt and equity, and convertible securities. That experience is in a variety of industries, including technology, applied technology, business services, and industrial companies. So, Doug, we'd love to hear who Doug McConnell is in his own words, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Ken. This is it's really a treat to be with you, and I've so enjoyed listening to your other episodes with some really, really top quality, impressive people. I'm flattered that I could be part of it. So this is wonderful.
Awesome! It's great to have you on board.
So you really hit the high points. I've been a swimmer for more than 50 years. I started as a little kid, like so many, as a 6 or 7 year old on a Park District's summer league team, and in my hometown, and I not because I was a good swimmer, but because my sisters were quite gifted, and I just wanted to tag along with them. I love being on a team. I love to race, and that's really what got me hooked. Our town didn't have an indoor pool, and so I swam for a YMCA through high school. Was a walk-on in college. My YMCA times weren't all that attractive to college recruiters. And went to the University of Illinois in the mid-70s and really enjoyed that team experience at a whole different level, to the point where I was fortunate. I was excuse me, most valuable swimmer a couple of years and the team captain one time. So it was college swimming was just an outstanding experience and one never to be forgotten. So the, you know, career and family and so forth kind of begin to take you away from things like swimming and so forth. Over several years after I was out of school, swimming was kind of hit and miss, mostly miss. And I would do some master's swimming here and there. And what I learned was that I really just loved the training. So it was, any excuse to kind of stay in the water, stay in the pool and so forth. At one point along the way, a brother-in-law of mine, who's quite a talented Ironman distance triathlete, got me into an open water swimming event in one of the lakes near Chicago. So I tagged along with him and got a free breakfast out of it, if I recall, but just had a blast in open water and discovered pretty quickly that, with a swimming background, it helps a lot, but open water swimming is really very different from pool swimming, where you don't really know where you're going. There's all of the variables that the pool takes away are reintroduced in open water. So you may bump into another athlete. You may swallow water because it's wavy and windy. You certainly can't see anything in front of you, and in certain circumstances, there are even there's even wildlife that will nibble on you. So it's it kind of introduces all of those variables that we left behind with the pool. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, you know, that sounds much more exciting.
It is, and it's you know, the challenges are kind of interesting. You know, people. A lot of people really shy away from cold water, as an example. And as time goes on, you discover that being able to withstand cold water and really get your head around different conditions and stuff is really almost a badge of honor and so forth. There are extremes and sort of limits to that too. But it really starts to open your eyes to what your body can do and kind of accomplish. So anyway, continuing on with our open water events, I started doing more of these swims that were a little bit longer in distance and a little bit farther from home and so forth. And finally, a discussion happened. I will admit there was wine involved. That the discussion of the English Channel came up, and the more wine we drank, the better it sounded. So one thing kind of led to another, and before long we were pretty convinced that we were headed to England. So it was a pretty exciting episode.
That's amazing. You never know what, you know, wine can do in a late night of, you know, that and some great ideas and signing up for. I can tell you there's lots of races I've been signed up with on, you know, some late nights and convinced to do. So
exactly.
It's a lot of fun. So marathon swimming, it's, you go for 24 miles, 29 miles. I'm sure there's, you know, longer ones. How do you fuel yourself for this type of stuff? Or how do you, do you ever stop? Do you hang on the side of a boat? How does the whole thing work? Like I said, yeah, you know, earlier, I just have no clue.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that there's a series of rules that everybody's expected to follow. They call them the English Channel rules, but there's oodles and oodles of these rules, but they really can kind of be boiled down into just three or four. And one of them is what you can wear. And the open water and marathon swimming world really frowns on wetsuits. And so anything that would make you warm, fast, or buoyant is off limits. So it's Speedo, swim cap, and goggles is the uniform. The second is that all swims start and finish on dry land. So you have to walk into the water, swim across, walk out. And that makes a successful swim. The third is what you can do during the swim, and namely, nobody can touch you, and you can't touch the escort boat. There's always an escort boat for safety reasons, but if you happen to touch the boat, it's an immediate disqualification. So some kind of obscure rules, but you bring up a great question about the nutrition issues. Especially in a colder water swim, you budget for burning 1,200 calories an hour. So it's, you're really going through a big calorie burn, and you know you can't consume anything that will replace 1,200 calories an hour. We use a drink that's very heavy carbohydrate. It's actually custom blended for us by a company down in Cincinnati called Infinite Nutrition. So you can dial up the carbohydrates, you can dial down or up the protein and the flavoring and the caffeine and all these other elements of the thing, depending on what the specific needs of your swim are. It's not really an environment where you can, you can eat solid food very easily. So you really want to get all your nutrition through that drink or bottle, which somebody on the crew throws to you like a trained seal. You drink it away, and then they reel it back in on a lanyard. we're typically on a 30-minute cycle for feeding. Some people will go as short as 20, others as long as 40. But at the end of 30 minutes, you you're feeling it, and you really, you know, having the opportunity to add in some additional calories is really welcome. It, again, in colder water swims, it's always nice when the crew heats the water before they blend it. The other thing that's sort of interesting about the 30-minute cycle is that I actually count my strokes while I'm swimming. And so I know it is 1,750 strokes until the next feed. And just to get your head around, you know, swimming a distance of, you know, many hours, you're really just swimming to the next feed. And I know I can put 1,750 strokes together almost anytime.
And how long does it take to do a marathon swim, a 24-mile swim or 29-mile swim?
You know, it totally depends. In part because you're dealing with currents and weather conditions and so forth. I mean, you mentioned the English Channel a while ago. 14 hours is really below the average on that swim. But then 5-foot waves are not typical. So it's a if you're going to get slapped around by big waves and things like that, it's going to take some extra time. The other thing that's interesting about a swim like the English Channel is that currents are predictable, but they are severe. And so the route that we took was not straight across 21 miles. It went in sort of a Z-shaped pattern to the point where our line was 33 miles long and to make 21. Now, you still only get credit for swimming 21 miles, but we traveled 33 to kind of get there. So unlike a running marathon or something like that, where you really know where the finish line is and how the conditions are going to be between the start and the finish. One of the real challenges of marathon swimming is that you don't, and you have to deal with the conditions as they come.
Right. Wow. That's amazing to do that in the currents. How do you know what the currents are going to be? Is there a forecast? How does that work?
Well, it just goes to show the importance of your team. The core of our team is really our family and some friends that we recruited into this. But the real key member of that team is the boat pilot, and to be familiar with local waters and how those currents are going to run and so forth. Here in England, we went 33 miles and just hit that finish line right on the button. We had a Hall of Fame boat pilot, and he's just as the best in the business. So you really kind of put your hands put your life in the hands of the boat pilot. You know, the other thing that's crazy about these swims is that for most of the time on these swims, you can't see the shore you came from or the shore you're swimming to. So you're just out in the middle of nowhere, and the boat has all the electronics on it. And the boat pilot knows where he's going. So you just follow the boat and ultimately you get there.
Wow. It's like the story of my life. But now do you go for, you know, English Channel, for example, do you go from England to France or do you France to England? Does it depend? Is there only one way to do it? Is that part of the rules?
Yeah, it is now. It used to be that you could do it either direction. And frankly, from the standpoint of the currents that run along the French shore, you'd be a lot better off starting in France, but the French government won't let people do that anymore. So all swims on that one start in Dover, England, and then they end up kind of near Calais, France. So it's a little bit south of Calais, but it's all one direction. Now, having said that, there are some marathon swimmers who have managed to do two and three legs of that swim, where they swim from Dover to from England to France, you know, stand on the beach for 2 minutes, and then they get right back in the water and swim back. Right. That was not our trip. We did one way.
Yeah, those are the overachievers. It's like doing the, you know, I know guys who do the, you know, the DECA Ironman, right? 10 Ironmans right. in a row or five Iron, and it's like, all right, guys, it's crazy. It's unbelievable. And it definitely, you know, tests your mettle when you're, so when you're swimming.
One of your guests a couple of weeks ago, was in a marathon that was, she ran 200 miles.
Yeah.
It's a mind bender. Yeah.
Believe me, I just did a race this summer that was like 3:350. That was on foot, paddling, riding bike, all that type of stuff. It's, I think probably more in swimming than in the other events, because you can really pay attention to, you know, sort of outside things, you know, when you're riding your bike or you're running or you're hiking or you're kayaking, because you're not in the water. Do you, and it sounds like you count your strokes. Is it a lot of mindfulness, I'm sure, involved in the whole process?
Well, it is for me. And I've talked to a number of people, and only a handful of other swimmers I've spoken to are also stroke counters. I actually started it many years ago to get a bad song out of my head. I couldn't listen to the song again. And so I thought that if I started to count, then maybe that would crowd out the song. And it worked. And the other thing I discovered was that it was a very good measure of time and distance. And so I just used that. And then and then I know when the next feeding is coming up. I know about how many miles we've traveled. I know about, you know, some of those kinds of things. And it I think I'm kind of a numbers guy anyway, but it's a good way to kind of keep your head in the game. My theory now is that I've never had that bonk where your brain just, you know, starts to cut off and rebel against your body. And I wonder if it's because of the counting that can actually work almost like a mantra.
Right. No, I think so. I know a lot of times too, when I do stuff like this, I'm counting a lot as well. And it could be a CrossFit workout or riding my bike. And it's always for me to get to the halfway point, because once you're to the halfway point, it's all downhill from there. Right. It's
right.
like,
right.
All right. You know, if you're doing 100 reps and you get I always have to get the 51, because now I know there's only 49 left versus 50 left. And you start playing those little games, and the suffering, it's still there, but it seems to go to the side more, because then it's math, right? It's no longer the workout. It's almost becomes math.
Right. Right. And I think that's more articulate than what I described, but I think that's really what it is.
Right. No, when you're running or riding the bike, it's always pace. It's doing math in your head the entire time. Like, oh, if I go this much faster or that, and I'm not even a math guy. And for some reason, I only do it when I'm working out. Other than that, I don't want to count anything or think about anything.
Well, it's been interesting to read about other people's or hear about other people's experiences as they train for a marathon or a triathlon or whatever. And they start to play little bite-sized games with themselves. You know, if I just run from here to the corner, or from, you know, to the lamppost or to the street sign or whatever it is, then it's a way to kind of get your head around the enormity of what you're trying to accomplish. And we found the same thing. I mean, you can't imagine climbing into the water in the middle of the night where, you know, everything is black and so forth, and then sort of say, oh, now I'm going to go swim 25 miles. I mean, it just doesn't really compute. And so if you can metaphorically go to the next lamppost or the next street sign, then it's a little bit easier to kind of get your head around. It's interesting. I had a conversation with a client the other day, and he's in the process of trying to acquire a company, which is what I do. And he was going to the strategy, the bidding strategy of what's it going to take to buy this company, and we should just come up with this whatever number it is and structure and so forth. And I said, no, what you have to do is just swim to the next feeding. What you have to do is just make it to the next round. You have to stay alive so that you don't get boxed out. And, you know, we can figure out later what the nuances of the structure or the valuation is and so forth, But at this point, all you have to do is swim to the next feeding. And I explained to him what I meant by the by swimming to the next feeding. And I have now heard back from him any number of times that all we're trying to do is swim to the next feeding. So it's I think there's an analog there with bidding for a company too.
Well, and yeah, that's if on your LinkedIn profile, it says you've used investment banking's lessons of teamwork to apply to, you know, your avocation of marathon distance swimming, right? It's, I think a lot of this stuff is becoming so synergistic of what you do and, you know, your avocation becomes your vocation or vice versa.
Well, and I think the, you're absolutely right in the, and I don't know that being an investment banker has made me a better marathon swimmer, but I know that being a marathon swimmer has made me a better investment banker. So it's, but I mean, it sounds cheesy, but really there are some interesting, you know, it's all done on a team basis. It's all a project where there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And in every deal or every swim, something's going to happen to one of your teammates. So everybody needs to be cross-trained, and something is going to happen that you don't expect, whether it's a big fish or a big wave or cold water, or you know everybody on the crew is seasick, and so you just need to be ready to kind of roll with those punches, and it begins and ends with a great team.
Right. No, and that's huge, right? You can't do any of this stuff without a great team. I know when we do the adventure racing, we have four people on our team and everyone's always, you know, what's someone has some strength that you don't have? Or if you do this stuff solo, like you're doing, but you also have people that are, you know, there that are feeding you or the boat pilot or someone helped guiding you throughout your transition.
Right. Right. It's just indispensable. I mean, to the point where, you know, I'm the teammate who wears the Speedo, but I mean, we couldn't do this without the whole bunch of us.
So talk to us, you know, we mentioned the other day, you said you're 61 years old, you're an investment banker, you're doing this. You know, how do you train? When do you train? Tell us a little bit about sort of your MO to keep this going.
Yeah. I'm an early morning training guy. Just growing up with swimming, you get accustomed to morning workouts and that sort of thing. And so, you know, 6 months a year, we're stuck indoors. We're suburban Chicago. So 6 months of the year, we're inside. And then 6 months of the year, you're able to get in the lakes and Lake Michigan and places like that. So it's a lot of grind. I mean, I train between, you know, 25 and 30,000 yards a week, which is 15 to 18 miles, I guess, in the water. And then in the summertime, it's nice because we can be outdoors and you're not having to count by 25 yard increments. And so that's always a lift. A couple of years ago, I started with some dry land training also. And that's helped a lot. I do that at home. I don't have to be in a gym to do it. And most of it is core exercises and really strengthening, your back and your abdominal muscles and that sort of thing. So that you can really put up with this kind of abuse for a lot of hours at a time. So it's, everything in our sport is kind of geared around the good weather that you get with summertime. So right now it was 10 below in Chicago this morning. So we're hoping against hope that it's starting to warm up soon.
Yeah. It'll be 5 below tomorrow. It'll be a little bit warmer. You should listen to, are you familiar with the VASA trainer for swimmers?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I actually had him, the founder of it, as an earlier episode. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty unique how he developed it and, you know, his thoughts behind the whole thing.
Yeah. And it's a great basis for swim training. And, you know, even age group swimmers are using those things now, really to great success.
How do you deal with the cold? A lot of people are probably like, you know, you're crazy. You're going in the water and in the 50s and that type of stuff.
You know, it's interesting. It's an example of your body teaching your brain that it's okay. And, you know, we always think that it goes the other way, where your brain is and your mind has to be under such control that it will teach your body things. And that's certainly true. I mean, there's any number of examples of that. But the but sometimes the opposite is true as well, and that is when you get into cold water, there are certain physiological reactions that you're always going to have. One of them, the scary one, frankly, is that it takes your breath away. It actually temporarily paralyzes your diaphragm, just as though you had the wind knocked out of you. Like if you fell hard on the small of your back, you kind of get that wind knocked out of you feeling. And it's exactly the same thing. In both cases, your diaphragm is temporarily paralyzed, and there's the panic of not being able to breathe and then forcing yourself to draw breath and so forth. And so there's a bunch of these little physiological reactions, and just getting accustomed to cold water doesn't make those go away. So you get in the first time and you breathe and you wheeze and try to draw breath and so forth. Well, the next time you get in, you know those things are going to happen again. So one of the things that I've discovered is that if it's water in the low 60 degree, Fahrenheit, obviously, if you get into water that's 62 or 63 degrees, I mean, you're going to feel that seize up and so forth. And if you just start swimming, if you count to 100, 100 strokes, you'll be breathing normally. And if the water's below 60, you might have to count to 200, but it's going to come. And so the next time you get in the water, you know, there's you have the same physiological reaction, but at least there's not as much panic and so forth. And so it's a process for sure. Getting accustomed to colder water is real necessary for some of these swims, just because those are the conditions you're going to be in. Well, the English Channel, for example, was 62 degrees the whole way. And again, trying to get your head around being in that water for 14 hours is something you better be ready for. It's also interesting because the more you go through this acclimation to colder temperatures and so forth, you discover that you're taking cooler showers and you don't need a sweater as much. And it's right. It really does kind of change your physiology a little bit.
Well, that's what we say in New England, right? In the first part of the winter, you're freezing, your blood's thin. And then by the end of the year, it's 40 degrees out and you're running in t-shirt and shorts because
you're shirt sleeves, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because it's like, oh my God, this is so, so crazy warm out. What's the coldest you've swam in?
You know, we did actually it was in your town in Boston. There's a fabulous open water event that they hold every year and have for 100 years, I think. And it's where you start at the Boston Light, which is the lighthouse way out in the harbor. It's the outermost island, I think. And so everybody gets on boats and they go out to the Boston Light and you jump in and then you swim to is it M Street in South Boston?
Right. Yes, exactly.
So it's an 8 mile swim plus or minus, and you weave through those beautiful islands in the Boston Harbor and so forth. It's just a magnificent swim, and the people who organize it are wonderful. But when we did it a few years ago, I remember watching the thermometer on the dashboard of our escort boat, and the thermometer was just going down. And when we finally got out to the light and he said, okay, time to hop in the water, it was 53. And it, now salt water helps a little bit, but 53 is cold water.
Oh, it is. Now, my wife's from Maine, and whenever we're up there, and even in the middle of summer, it's high 50s, low 60s. Is what, if it's in mid 60s, it feels like bath water. It's unbelievable.
Right. You got to be ready for that.
Yeah, you got to be. And then at that point, yeah, it's an interesting way to go swimming in the summer. What about, you had mentioned too, you're going to be running the race in Chicago, in the Chicago River. Talk to us about that. That sounds pretty exciting.
It really is, and so quick backstory. is we're supporting a charity, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But the one of the things that we wanted to do was to raise more money for the nonprofit. We started to host swims in the Chicago area. So we have one in Lake Michigan and a couple in the lakes out in the suburbs and so forth. And they really cater to triathletes. You know, in a, even in a market like Chicago, of course, you can't count the number of competitive running events that there are, and now even cycling events. But the number of swimming events was, you know, you could count them on one hand. And for most triathletes, swimming is their weakest event. And that's the one where they need the most work and the most competitive kind of conditions and so forth. So starting a few years ago, A Long Swim began to host these competitive open water events, and they've become pretty popular. It's been pretty gratifying. So starting 2 or 3 years ago, we had the idea of jumping onto the urban swim idea. And New York is an example, now Boston, other cities, San Francisco, other cities around the world, had these urban swims where people are swimming right through the middle of a center city and so forth. So here's Chicago now with the Chicago River, and it's perfect because it goes right through the loop. And it's really a kind of a, well, frankly, the reason that Chicago's there in the first place. We did a little bit of research and learned that there were really active competitive swims in the Chicago River that stopped about 80 or 90 years ago. You know, and people like John Weissmuller and Buster Crabb and so forth, we've seen pictures of these, of John Weissmuller swimming in the Chicago River in the 20s. And then of course the quality of the water was substandard and so forth. Well, in the last 30 years or so, there have been a lot of good progress made to clean up the conditions of the Chicago River and so forth, to the point where it really is swimmable. Then we went through the process of kind of getting the city and the park district and Coast Guard and everybody else who has to say grace over this to allow us to host an event. So right now we are, I think we're calling it conditionally approved for an open water swim event that'll be late this summer, early fall in the Chicago River. It'll be a couple miles long, and the plan is to start at a park on the near south side and then swim right through the loop and get out at the Dearborn Street Bridge. So it's a pretty exciting opportunity.
I know, that's one question I had. That sounds amazing. And what about the pollution? Oh, Boston Harbor, New York City, right. Chicago River. What's, you know, how do you overcome that? Or are they all pretty much swimmable now just due to, you know, environmental?
You know, there really has been so much improvement in all of the rivers that you just mentioned. When we swam in New York a few years ago, they did recommend that we get a couple of vaccinations, which I did and didn't have any trouble, whatever. I swam in the Chicago River in August of just last year. So what, 4 or 5 months ago, and it didn't even taste bad. So I think that, you know, at least in the case of Chicago, I think it is a perception more than the reality. And certainly for anybody who's grown up around Chicago, who has, you know, has watched the river over those years, you know, it was really repulsive. And it's not all that many years ago when it was pretty bad. But between the imposition of clean water standards and really policing some of the industry that's on the river, and taking care of some of those things. I mean, you know, the beauty of a river is that if you just stop pouring crap into it, it will clean itself. And that's what we saw in New York. That's what they've seen in the Charles River in Boston, and certainly in the Chicago River. And so we're really hoping to use this as kind of a celebration of the improvement of the water quality in Chicago.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that's it. It's right. If water is moving, it typically flushes itself out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, talk to us a bit about your charity and what you're doing there from the philanthropic side and how that's tied in with your swimming.
Yeah, it's from the beginning, we have supported ALS research. ALS is Lou Gehrig's disease, of course, is a disease that has hit my family very hard. And it is it's a terribly cruel disease for which there's no cure. However, the pace of research discovery is really accelerating now. And I mean, there's exciting news almost every month that's coming out. So from the get-go, we decided that we wanted to support ALS research so other families wouldn't go through what our family has. We named our effort A Long Swim. We borrowed the acronym from ALS, and it's really been rewarding to kind of embark on this. To date, we've raised more than $500,000, and most of which has gone to collaborative projects that they kind of quarterback over at Northwestern University, which again, right in Chicago, and happens to be one of the top ALS research centers in the world. And so it's been pretty gratifying to be able to do that. The other, you know, from just a high level viewpoint, putting a niche sport like marathon swimming together with a niche disease like ALS made sense. And the other element, of course, ALS slowly robs the patient of their ability to use their muscles, and even to the point where ultimately breathing is a challenge, and food digestion and so forth. I mean, it's a horrible thing to witness. And so with swimming, of course, you have to use all your muscles all the time, and you have to breathe deeply, and you have to. So it's almost a defiance of this disease that we for which we use swimming as the vehicle, and it's really resonated with people. We've been super fortunate of course, the donors. It just knocks your head off to see how people will be charitable and generous and so forth. It's really been unbelievable. And, you know, and as time goes on, we're hoping to use swims like the Chicago River we were just talking about and some other swims that we've got scheduled coming up and so forth to be able to support this, this ALS research effort. So it's been really rewarding.
Oh, that's great. Now, we actually had one of our neighbors pass away of ALS, and my daughter and all them, they were out raising money and doing all that type of stuff. So yeah, it's not a fun disease.
It's a shipwreck. And, you know, it's now 5 years ago, 4 years ago, when the Ice Bucket Challenge actually also started right in Boston.
Yep.
Came along, and, you know, of course, it was lightning in the bottle, and for a few weeks that summer, everybody knew about ALS, and whether we're doing a marathon swim or we're standing on a street corner for tag days, the impact of that Ice Bucket Challenge cannot be overstated. I mean, it was such a magical event, and not only did it create so much awareness, but it generated a lot of money. I mean, there was just an avalanche of money that came into ALS research. I mean, to the point where really every promising ALS research project around the world is pretty well funded at this point. And so it's really been an exciting way to kind of kickstart a lot of those developments. It's really been a good time to be involved in ALS research. I mean, my heart bleeds for your neighbor. It's a horrible thing for a family to go through.
No, it's terrible. But anyways, wow, we're almost hitting here 40 minutes of this just going. It seems like we just keep going forever and ever. I love talking about this stuff, and then especially stuff I have know nothing about, which is fascinating. This whole marathon swimming thing is just crazy. But it's, you know, that That's a sport for rugged guys. So congratulations, or rugged people. I actually know some women who do it too. So it's not,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that. It's really becoming kind of a women's sport.
Right.
It's for a lot of, you know, men and women really compete at parity. And one of the statistics that is interesting, the average woman is, this is for the English Channel now, the average woman is an hour faster than the average man, which is, you know, like 2 miles faster.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's really a significant difference. And you know, of course, the physiologists are all over statistics like that to figure out why women are really better equipped at this sport than men are.
Well, women are doing it in ultra running too. They're beating a lot of the men in a lot of the longer races as well. It's, you know, they're almost at par. I think the fastest known time on the Appalachian Trail was within minutes of, you know, a woman had done it and a man was working super hard to break it and only broke it by like 45 minutes or something. It was, you know, it wasn't anything. And, you know, the crazy thing is, I don't think she was trying as hard as he was. So, you know, if you know, they'd really put their head down, they would have, you know, they would have been. And there might be, you know, the endurance might be, there's something physiologically that's different.
And I think there's an observation that I have made and I've read a little bit about, and that is that women are much more patient in their willingness to do a lot of training for a relatively short event. You know, as little boys grow up, they do a practice and then play a game, and so forth. And so they kind of get into that, you know, the ratio of training time to competition time is much more balanced. And for some reason, women seem to be able to skew that much better in their, you know, it's just from a mental standpoint.
And they're also, all the women in my family are smarter than I am too. So,
well, that's maybe a given.
But anyways, so where can people find you? Where can they find, you know, your site?
Yeah, no, we have alongswim.org. That has a lot of information about some of the marathon swims that we've done and so forth, and also the nonprofit side of this and what we're supporting. Then of course I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn and all the rest, but it's it should be pretty easy to find me.
This was awesome, Doug. Thank you very much for being part of this.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for hosting and I love the podcast and I'm just thrilled to be part of it.
Awesome. No, thank you very much. And for any of the listeners who have any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to reach out to me at kenandtheexecutiveathletes.com. But go out there and train hard. Just keep it rolling every day. Thanks.